What did you run through? What were your basic responsibilities?
Well, this was a new system, this country directive system, instituted by the Johnson administration. And basically, what we country directors were supposed to do was coordinate American policy towards our countries across the board. And I would have regular meetings. Sort of the Washington-Iran country team would meet as the ambassador's country team would meet in Tehran, and I'd have representatives of the other agencies involved in Iranian affairs in Washington come to my office, and we would discuss the situation and what questions lay before us and what decisions we had to get from our superiors and so forth and so on. And I thought it was a very effective mechanism, and it required people at my level in the State Department to really take a leadership role and play a leadership role. In the case of Iran, as I say, we had top level support for the policies the embassy was espousing and that I was supporting, so I didn't have too many problems in running it. Other country directors had different problems.
Now, who were some of the influential people in Washington in the executive agencies who participated in making decisions on Iran? People at other agencies were involved in these things.
Well, over in defense, it was largely the people either in ISA or in the military credit thing. Henry Cuss in the military credit thing in ISA. Tim Hoops, I think Joe Jordan, Amos Jordan was involved in this period. He's now at CSIS Georgetown. In fact, he runs CSIS Georgetown. Over in the White House, it was Howard Riggins, who's now at Columbia, and Hal Saunders, who was at American Enterprise Institute. In aid, I've mentioned McCumber and Fanari. I may have forgotten some of the people in aid. I didn't have very many problems with Treasury or Commerce or the economic side of the government. Well, there was a very interesting guy, very, very helpful man in the Ex-Im Bank named William Welk, W-E-L-K. And he was an old-timer in the Ex-Im Bank. I don't even know whether he's still alive. He'd be quite elderly if he is, but he was a key figure in that period. And then in the State Department, the chain of command was Rockwell, who was by then Deputy Assistant Secretary, my direct superior. And then the assistant secretary, who in that period was Raymond Hare, a longtime pro, and then it became Parker Hart, Pete Hart, and then it became, I may have the order wrong here, it must have been Luke Battle, Raymond Hare, Pete Hart, but those were the three. There was sort of a musical chairs in the assistant secretary.
Lucius Battle,
and Ray Hare and Pete Hart were all involved in that period. Uh-huh. And then when the Nixon administration came in, it was Joe Sisko, but I left and went to the seventh floor about that same period. Then further on up, occasionally the deputy undersecretary for political affairs would get involved, and that was first Charles E. Bolin and then U. Alexis Johnson. But for some reason or other, the undersecretary for economic affairs, Eugene Rostow, who's still at Yale, kept getting involved in things Iranian. He had a great interest in Iran, but he also was very, very much in favor of our policy supporting the Shah. And then went up to Dean Rusk. The undersecretary, Katzenbach, whoever it was, essentially didn't play much of a role. So those were the key players.
Was Abel Harriman ever involved in
Harriman was involved. I guess in the Johnson administration, that period, he was ambassador at large or counselor. Yeah. He wasn't in the chain of command. But no, I once flew out to Iran with Harriman. The date I will not resurrect. Actually, I really bummed a ride on the plane, but I briefed him on the way out. He was out to see the Shah, but he was actually out to dedicate, and this is how you could find out what the date was. Otherwise, he was out to help dedicate the Tarbella Dam in Pakistan. But Harriman was certainly a very close to the Shah, and had his confidence, and vice versa. And the Johnson administration used him from time to time with the Shah. Now, the Shah came to Washington, I think, while I was country director, maybe three times. And Hoveyda came once. And so we had those visits that occupied a tremendous amount of my time preparing for them. And they were always very successful. I remember after dinner once at the White House, after a state dinner for the Shah, seeing LBJ and the Shah disappear into the garden arm in arm, you know. And they're very, very different men, but they saw the world through very similar eyes. And there was a real rapport there, which made my job really terribly easy.
I'll have more questions about that later on.
Yeah.
Who at CIA, was there anybody in particular that worked on Iran during those years, the late 60s?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly I had a lot of liaison with them on analytical questions. And the same thing was true of INR, the research part of the State Department. I'd have to think about who the people were that I was dealing with, and certainly with INR, you asked me earlier whether there was any opposition to our policy towards Iran, and there was some in INR. There was a man named Archie Bolster who used to give me quite a hard time occasionally on the basis that we were overly supportive of the Shah, and this would in due course lead to all kinds of problems. Archie stuck to his guns very well, and history proved him to be right. It's always just a question of how long it takes history to work its way. But I don't recall similar warnings coming out of CIA in that period. I think INR and the Department, in addition to AID, were the principal critics of our policy.
I read somewhere that someone in INR did do a study, 55 or 66. This may well have been the person who's in it.
May have been Archie Bolster, yeah. He'd be another person who should be in this oral interview if you have time.
What kind of analyses did CIA people prepare for the State Department or for executive agencies generally? Did they do in-depth political studies?
I've forgotten what they call the reports, but we got regular reporting. Of course, the agency, as you know, had its own interest in Iran in terms of some of the facilities aimed at the Soviet Union. And the importance of this aspect of our relations should not be underestimated, because those facilities were of enormous importance to the United States. And often when we came to key policy decisions, should we or should we not support the Shah, part of the rationale for supporting him was he's giving us these facilities. And of course the Shah and we saw eye to eye on the fundamental Soviet threat. There was an aspect sometimes of payment for those facilities particularly in our military assistance program.
Did you get the, how involved was Rusk in Iran?
Very much involved. Yeah, I of course he was involved whenever the Shah came. He'd been in Tehran. I can't remember in that period how often he himself went to Tehran, but he was very much involved and really was a decisive player often in policy decisions. And I would take the Iranian ambassador to see him quite often, so he kept himself well informed.
So he had an interest in the question. I mean,
Dean Rusk was very much involved. No, absolutely no question about that.
Okay.
I mean, Iran was, as it is today, some Americans sometimes forget this, Iran is an enormously important country, and you can't be Secretary of State without spending some of your time thinking about Iran.
Okay. Who were some of the Iranian officials that you dealt with in Washington?
The key one while I was country director was the Ambassador Hushang Ansari. His predecessor was a man named Khosravani. Yeah, Khosravani.
How do you spell that?
K-H-O-S-R-O-V-A-N-I. Pretty sure I'm right. Getting confused now between Khalat Bari and Khosravani.
I can always look it up.
Yeah. His predecessor was old school diplomat, whose principal worry was how to write letters to the New York Times when the New York Times would print something derogatory about the Shah. In other words, he was covering his ass back in Tehran. Ansari Maghazali stopped that attitude right away. He said, my job is to go talk to the editors of the New York Times myself and tell them why I think they're wrong. And he was very effective. He had very sharp elbows. He was a very pushy character and not a very pleasant person to deal with. But he was enormously effective, first really effective Iranian ambassador in terms of getting out around Washington and trying to make friends and influence people.
Did he have much influence back in Tehran? Did you have a sense he was an influential figure in his own?
Oh, I think he was. I think the Shah respected him, and the Shah appointed him.
Yeah.
And I think he felt that he was the kind of person Americans would be able to communicate easily with. I had regular one-on-one lunches with Ansari where he would tell me his problems and I'd tell him my problems about current policy issues. But I wasn't the only person he'd had one-on-one lunches with. I think he realized the country director was a key player, but by far not the only player. He'd do that with people in the Defense Department and senators and other people. He really knew how to work Washington.
Okay, so did you pick up Farsi language?
I studied Farsi. Yeah. I must say that when I was in Iran, except when I traveled in the boonies, I didn't really have much occasion to use it, because particularly on the economic financial side, Iranians knew English. I used it some. I didn't really become proficient in the language until I went to Afghanistan in the 70s.
I have questions about petroleum issues. There were some tensions apparently in relationships with the Shah during the late 60s, 67, 68, in those years. Did you get a sense, how would you define, from what you could tell, the Shah's basic objectives in terms of petroleum?
Money.
Policy.
He just wanted more money.
Yeah.
And any way he could squeeze the oil companies, he would squeeze them, and he would use whatever kind of pressure he could use, direct, indirect threats, God knows what else. Of course, once OPEC came along, he had some solidarity with the other major oil producers in the Gulf. But one oil company executive at that time was, in a way, my mentor in teaching me about the politics of oil in that part of the world. A fellow still around here in San Francisco, George Ballou, then with Standard Oil of California.
George, what was his name?
George Ballou, B-A-L-L-O-U. And there are a lot of interesting characters in the oil business who knew the Shah very well, of course. He told me the name of the game out here is give a little today to live tomorrow. And the oil companies, were very effective at giving just barely enough to live tomorrow. And everything went fine, of course, until 73 when the whole thing blew up. We were also involved in issues in those days having to do with the exploitation of those parts of Iran that were not under control of the consortium, and this largely had to do with resources out in the Gulf, offshore, and there were some very interesting problems in how you demarcate the lines there as between Iran and the Arab states on the other side of the Gulf. Armin Meyer did some very, very useful work in particularly with respect to the demarcation line between the Saudis and the Iranians. And a number of new players came in, such as Standard of Indiana in that period, which hadn't been involved with oil exploration and exploitation in Iran before. The oil picture was always hopping, and of course Hobeid himself was associated at one point with the National Iranian Oil Company, and Iqbal was a major figure in the oil company, and the Shah paid just as much attention to oil as I think he did to military equipment. That was his financial lifeblood.
Did the oil companies come to the State Department from time to time complaining about the Shah's pressure on them to produce more revenue?
Well, it wasn't so much complaining as consulting with us on how to handle it and telling us how they were trying to handle it.
Uh-huh.
And it's a whole interesting chapter there, which I was never really involved in and don't remember the details, having to do with antitrust provisions and waiver given the major consortium players of antitrust provisions so they could really act as a consortium. This continued to be high politics, of course, right up to the fall of the Shah.
How far was the department willing to go on their behalf in terms of if they wanted assistance to protect their interests from the Shah, how far would the State Department go in meeting the requests for assistance when they were made?
Well, we were really in the middle, because sometimes we were saying to them, gee, can't you be a little more helpful to the Shah? He's got some real problems, and a few more dollars might help solve those problems. On the other hand, we also recognize these were American companies, and part of our job is to help them protect their interests. So, by and large, I think the State Department was really in a diplomatic middle position on many of these petroleum issues. And they were tough issues for both sides. Our main interest was maintaining the American presence in the oil industry in Iran, which, until the whole thing started falling apart in the 70s, I think happened. And the consortium, I've forgotten when it's the news finally occurred, so it lasted for quite a while.
72, 73.
Yeah.
Besides Andy Ballou, you mentioned, who were some of the other major corporate officials that
you deal with? George Piercy, who I think was Exxon. Howard Page, I think, was also Exxon. I can't remember, besides Ballou, who was a major player here with Standard of California. Page and Piercy are the two names that I really remember as being spokesmen for the consortium. And Ballou was never the CEO of a petroleum company. He was the man behind the scenes.
Okay. I have specific questions about these issues, and maybe you can answer some of them.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
In the spring of 66, the Shah began to press the consortium for more revenue. He wanted to increase production so he could get more revenue, basically. There was some apprehension that the Shah might take rash action. That was a quote that was used in some memo. Might take rash action to get the companies to cooperate. What kind of threats did he make? Or did he make threats about what he might do?
I don't, on those specific issues, recall the details anymore. I do recall, yes, that he was making threats, and they had to do with a whole variety of issues, including what territory he'd allow the consortium to continue to operate in, and things of that kind. But I couldn't pin specific threats to specific dates anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one aspect of this whole issue was something that was called the aggregate program quantity system, which members of the consortium framed to control production from Iran. They said they could prevent overproduction and falling prices. Did you learn about that system?
I knew about it. Yeah. The APQ system. Yeah. It all comes back. But yeah. Boy, you'd have to ask Ed McGinnis, sir, or one of the oil boys to recall the details. That kind of thing wasn't my.
Yeah.
I guess when I was country director in 66-69, I had to know a lot more about it than I did in that period. But I'll tell you another person may know a lot about that, and that's Jim Akins, who was later our ambassador to Saudi Arabia.
Right.
But in a lot of this period, when I was country director, he was running the oil part of the State Department in the Economic Bureau, and he was really the expert on oil. I was more involved in the political, financial, policy aspects.
Uh-huh. During some of the meetings of oil issues, one person, I guess Park person, Standard Oil, he suggested that the Hickenlooper amendment be brought into the situation to give the U.S. leverage, in the sense that the U.S. could threaten to cut off grant aid or aid or credits altogether if the Shah made any further demands upon the corporations. Was this ever discussed seriously, that kind of
thing? I don't recall. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
If it had been, both sides were capable of making threats.
Yeah.
As I say, we were in the middle.
Yeah.
We were trying to keep the peace and had our eye on the essential ball, which was to maintain the Shah's revenue flow while at the same time maintaining the position of the oil companies in Iran and protecting them as American commercial enterprises.
Uh-huh.
The British, of course, were involved in this too. BP had the major share of the consortium. So it wasn't just, to put it mildly, an American show. So our petroleum attaché, McGinnis or whoever it was closely in touch with his counterpart in the British Embassy.
Did you work with the British also on these issues from time to time, you personally, or was it more?
Not too much, because it was handled by the petroleum fella. But certainly, when I was country director, I continued to see a lot of the British. British interests in Iran were very similar to ours, and their record of experience was much longer. And the British ambassador at that time, Dennis Wright, became a very close friend of mine. At one point, the country director for Saudi Arabia, Bill Brewer, and I went on a mission to London to discuss with the British the withdrawal of the British from the Gulf, which I guess was consummated in 71. But in the early stages of that, when I was country director, we were involved. And there was a real question as to whether we'd be choosing up sides between the Saudis and the Iranians. Obviously, none of us wanted to choose up sides. But those of us who were working on the Iranian side of the Gulf wanted to make sure that our policymakers realized that Iran was just as important a country as Saudi Arabia.
Did you make any trips to Tehran during this period to work on the petroleum issues, or was that one
of
the other people?
Not
the other people
per se. I made at least two or three trips to Iran when I was country director to work on issues across the board and to mess around the country to see what was going on and so on and so on.
In June 67, during the Egypt-Israel war, apparently the Shah did not participate in the Arab, there was a temporary Arab boycott of oil to the Western powers. Did he closely coordinate this policy with the U.S., do you recall?
Well, you know, the Shah always had this special relationship with Israel, and he was never, as we've talked about before, he always looked with a jaundiced eye on the radical Arabs.
Yeah.
Again, I don't remember the details of our conversations with him in those days. Gene Rostow was very much involved at that time, and that's certainly something you should ask him about.
Okay.